Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Vaishnavi Sundar. She's a self-taught filmmaker, writer, and feminist activist from Chennai, India. She's been making films from 2013, and they're all centered around women's lives and experiences. Her previous film was a four-part documentary called Dysphoric, which is available on YouTube to watch. I recommend people watch it. Her upcoming film is called Behind the Looking Glass, a documentary logging the experiences of women whose partners, quote, transitioned, and she's seeking funds to complete it. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Derek. It's always so exciting to talk to you. And I'm really glad that you have me on whenever I have a project coming up. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks. It's always great to talk with you, too. And I'm going to introduce a term here, and I hope it's okay that I use it. I know some women whose partners, quote, transitioned. And the phrase that they use sometimes is trans widows. First off, are you okay with that term? And second, tell us about the whole concept. People might not know what that means.
Sure, absolutely. I'm perfectly okay with the term because it's the term that the women have chosen for themselves. And considering the trans rights activists consider their quote unquote previous life slash male life as a dead one, or calling them by their previous name as dead naming, it makes perfect sense that the women who were married to them are considering that their partners have actually died and consider themselves widows. And for all kinds of reasons, we have other terminologies like golf widows and other things. So people don't seem to take any offense for that. And if this is what the women would like to call themselves, then it's perfectly fine by me. And trans widows is a terminology, it's just been popularized rather recently, and it's a terminology that has brought a lot of women together from around the world who have had shared experiences with the way their marriage has turned out, in that the man that they have married, who they have dated, fallen in love with, and probably married for a decade or so in some cases, sometimes more, one fine day just decided that he is now, quote unquote, a woman. And that they either no longer want to continue being married to this woman, or they want to force them to stay married while this spouse continues to parade around as a quote-unquote woman. So the collective experience of all these women are now sort of logged on the World Wide Web under the terminology of trans widows. That's kind of the summary of it.
So what are what are some of the commonalities of these women's experiences, and insofar as you want, then talk about how you're going to address that in the upcoming film?
Yes, definitely. The commonalities are kind of striking. In fact, a lot of these experiences that the women have talked to me about seem rather interchangeable in some way. And I'm not saying this in any sort of a trivialized manner, because each woman going through this experience is traumatized beyond belief. So while each woman has experienced this, when I have spoken to about 40 women, when each of them have narrated it to me, it seems as if I'm just talking to this one woman over and over again for 40 times. But at the same time, it also seems somewhat unique, because the patterns of abuse have been similar, in that they have had husbands who have manipulated them, gaslighted them, made them appear as if they are a horrible person for not instantly, quote unquote, affirming their gender identity. And if there are kids involved, there are almost always issues with regards to custody, and the mother is often terrified to leave the children in the custody of the ex-husband, because she's worried that he will put the children through some of the gender identity things themselves. And unfortunately, some of the children of these families are ending up identifying as trans themselves. So this fear is very, very legitimate. So the commonalities have been the patterns of abuse, boundary pushing, boundary violation, all of those things seem very, very similar. What is also similar is the way with which these women have come away from it and look back at it and are seeking that experience as a way of moving further, in a way that they are now looking at this new life of the chapter being over in the past and seeking experience from that, seeking strength from that, rather than, you know, just being completely broken. They were at one point, but they have managed to hold on to that resilience, believed in themselves, and come away from it. Some are unfortunately still married to their partners, because for various reasons like financial dependency and so on. But for those who have moved on, and for those who have had this experience many, many years ago, they are able to look back and tell other women who are probably in a similar situation that it will get better. And to me, those commonalities were so striking. One end of it is just the most traumatizing part of it, where the husbands have been treating them in a rather similar way. The other end of it was the way with which these women have come away from it, kicking and screaming, and now in a position to say that, well, it happened to me. I'm here. I'm still here, and I will carry on speaking about this and things like that. So it started out with like a thought in my head while I was making Dysphoric, my previous film, where transgender ideology has affected women and girls in a certain way, where they themselves are opting to transition themselves, etc. But I was wondering, how else could this ideology affect women? Because I'm interested in making films only about women. And I was thinking, if women are opting to transition, men too are opting to transition. So what's happening to the partners of these men who are, you know, choosing to transition at a later stage when they are, say, married and have children, etc.? So that sort of thought was there while I was editing this story, and then stumbled upon a couple of stories online, and that's when I learned about the term trans widows myself. And a bunch of trans widows actually wrote to me after having watched Dysphoric. So the thought was always there, and all of these signs came to me, you know, as a way to reaffirm to myself that this is the project that I need to sort of bring to life next. And that's how it all came together.
I want to go back to something you said in a moment, but before then, are the women that you talked to, that you've talked to so far, the 40 women or so, are they around the world, or are they geographically centered in one area?
They are around the world, but the large majority of them, as you can imagine, are from the US and the UK. I would attribute that to the fact that women are more forthcoming in these two countries because of the conversation around this in their country, in their respective countries. They're able to speak out about this. Or in these countries, it has happened to them many, many years ago that they are no longer under any threat to speak about it, or fear of cancellation, etc. There are also women that I've spoken with who are from Germany, Australia, Japan. And I also spoke with two women from France and Belgium. So it's kind of a worldwide phenomenon. And the number of women who were willing to speak to me in the film, for the film, large majority of them are from the US and the UK. But that is not to say that this is centered merely in the US and UK, as most of these gender identity ideology related things are. But the impact of it is kind of worldwide. And I know for a fact that there are women in India too whose husbands have, you know, sought quote unquote sex reassignment surgery, and women are looking at it as a viable reason why they should divorce these men, etc. So I know this happens in India, and I know there is a subculture within the Hijra community where there are men who have for a very, very long time lived this double life where they will be married, they have children, etc. But they also have this other life where they will cross-dress and perhaps solicit to do prostitution, etc. So this is a phenomenon that exists worldwide, but for the sake of the film, a large majority of them come from the UK and US, although we also have voices from Japan, Australia, and Germany.
So the common narrative that is in the mainstream press these days is that the males who identify as transgender are pretty much the single most oppressed group on the planet, and how it is absolutely life-saving and crucial, and you're a hateful bigot if you do not, quote, affirm them, end quote. And yet here, you talked about how traumatic the experience of having one's husband declare that he is a woman, how traumatic that can be. Can you talk both about the mainstream narrative about this, and also about the women's, what is this more traumatic? Is what the women are saying, is this more traumatic than a relationship simply ending? And if so, how so? Do you see what the two questions I'm asking?
Sure, I can go. Firstly, of course, the media is very much interested in the stunning and brave stories of these men who suddenly decided the first thing they want to do in their pursuit to become a quote woman is to have a gigantic breast and a wig and all of these false eyelashes and makeup and everything, stuff that feminists have been trying to completely kick away from our lives, you know, because it is oppressive, it is patriarchal, it is expecting women to sort of be molded into some sort of a standard which is desirable for men, etc. So we hear about the stunning and brave stories of these men who would like to now consider themselves to be the most oppressive community of the world. And if you do happen to hear about the wives at all, it would be of wives who have supported them, affirmed them, and have continued to remain married with them as a quote lesbian. So it is true that mainstream media is absolutely not interested in the women who are resisting this, who are speaking out against this, much less want to center their narrative about the wives that are left behind, because it is just not glamorous enough for them. It is not going to get them clicks. It is yet another sob story of women that the world doesn't care about, just like it wouldn't in any sort of a violence or domestic abuse sort of circumstances where women are speaking out about this, but the world doesn't give a damn. The women that have spoken in the film,
except to consider them bigots, of course.
Of course, they are Nazis, they're fascists, they are literally murdering the stunning and brave narrative of these men who have been so brave to wear women's panties to their workplace and click pictures of themselves in such a hypersexualized manner, which I don't know. I honestly wonder what they think a woman is when we see images of them online this way. And if that is what they think a woman is, I genuinely can't understand how the media can continue glorifying these men and their stories.
Just one more thing, which is Andrea Long Chu, who has written how women are
literally holes.
He's written this, and he just won a Pulitzer Prize. I just need to point that out.
He did.
So he's not just a media darling, but he literally won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, and he has openly written about how he considers women are to be raped, and that is what a woman is. You know, an object that should be raped, could be raped, etc. And that's what he wants himself to be. And that's the story that the media is glorifying, no less with the Pulitzer Prize. So the stories about the women, whether they consider this trans influence in their marriage that has ended to be any more traumatic than they would have felt if a marriage had ended for any other reason. Yes, they feel extremely traumatized by it because they can't move on ever from a marriage that has ended where one of the partner is trans-identifying, because the whole world is continuing to stand outside the door of your house and championing this man who has abused you. You open the newspaper, that's what you see. You open TV, that's what you see. You go online, that's what you see. It's like this car that is constantly being poked at throughout, not letting it heal whatsoever. Like, if you dare to move on, the media or the world will find a way to make you feel horrible about having left this man or having put them through so much trauma, etc. Completely mindless about all the trauma that the woman is going through or the children are going through, or just what horrible consequences the children will go through when they grow up, having experienced this confusion of calling their fathers mom and things like that. So it is different in that I'm divorced, and though the trauma has never left me, I know for a fact that there is now some sort of an acceptance for women who have opted to end a marriage that was abusive in nature, and the world doesn't treat me like I'm some horrible monster for not having lived through that marriage, no matter how much trauma I'm being subjected to. But in this case, that is what the world is telling the wives, you know. You just did not love him enough. You just do not understand how oppressed he feels. You know, you are just a horrible person to have left him at this very important juncture of his life, etc., is what they tell him. So, yes, definitely, the trauma seems to be, I can't quantify it as, you know, that it is more or less, but it definitely is preventing them from healing and moving on.
I bring this up because we already mentioned Andrea Long Chu, who talked explicitly about how important pornography was to his perception of himself as identifying as a woman. And do many of the women that you talk to, did many of them talk about the role or any role that pornography might play in the men's decisions?
A vast majority of them did. There's probably an exception, a small exception, where their motivation towards this ideology wasn't originated from watching internet pornography, or even, you know, back in the day, just pornography that was available on print, etc. There are just a couple of them whose venture into this hasn't been driven by pornography, but the rest of them, almost all of them, watch internet pornography, have been found with pornography that includes trans-identified males, animals, children, etc. So you've got the whole gamut of all the unspeakable kind of pornographic images and videos found on the devices of these men, and the absolute horror that these women faced when they found out all of these things, and the very casual way in which it was completely hidden away, and how in retrospect, all of those times when the man was not available or quote unquote working late, the women in retrospect realized that this is what he was probably doing, is watching pornography and probably masturbating, etc. We can't be sure because they are only able to speculate about it. But a large majority of them, pornography has played a very, very solid role. Some of them have started watching it from a very young age. Some of them have come to a point where they have watched. You know how addiction works, right? You watch something and at one point the pleasure stops coming in unless you up the game a bit. It's like coke or heroin as well. Like, you have a certain amount of drug. It doesn't cut it anymore because you've been having it for so long. The pain and pleasure kind of tallies itself. So you need to have more, and then there's more pain, and then you have to have more pleasure, etc. So the cycle is endless. Similarly, the men who consume pornography, they just keep escalating what they can consume. So that's when you find bestiality, pedophilia, etc., sort of becoming part of their pornographic worldview. And in some cases it could just be plain addiction. And now the way the world is glorifying that you watch all of these things, if you even suspect that could you be trans, then you are probably trans, etc., it gives them a nice excuse to completely stash away their really horrendous, grotesque life as a person who consumes pornography under the veneer of being this stunning and brave trans woman, you see. So to answer your question, yes, all of them, almost all of them, have had pornographic experience. And for some of them, this has been the singular most reason why they decided that they want to go down this path, and they believe now that they are indeed a woman, and not just any woman, but the most hypersexualized version of a woman that would make any woman's skin crawl.
So I'm sure that there will be some listeners who are listening to the last 4 or 5 minutes here and going, wow, that's a really terrible thing for them to say. But I just want to point out that we are here, you and I are both saying, in saying pornography plays a role in this, we're both saying the exact same thing that the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize said. It's just he's calling it a good thing and we're calling it a bad thing.
Yes, he is calling it a very good thing. And in fact, he is encouraging young men who have these doubts, quote unquote, to find themselves through pornography, and that how pornography has liberated him, and how pornography has driven him down this road. And imagine as a young man who is probably on a similar path, you see this man go forth and say all of these outlandish things, brazen things so openly, and go on to win the most prestigious literary award. What kind of example are we setting? You know, so does a young gullible boy think then that this path is the right path to go? Because after all, this man has won a Pulitzer Prize. Is this for me? Perhaps it is for me, because if I go down this way, maybe even I can win a Pulitzer Prize. The world has basically slapped women and women's rights and women's rights activists so hard with this one that I think it would be so hard to come out of it, you know, and to get ourselves back on our foot and start fighting again.
You know, this all of this conversation makes me think of the line by Germaine Greer about most women have no idea how much men hate them.
Absolutely, Derek. I'm with you.
It's, and you know, this also makes me think about, you know, my mom's experience, that my father was very abusive. And when my parents got divorced, my mother was the one who got kicked out of the church. And
wow.
The point is that I was thinking of that because of what you said about how, you know, these days a divorced woman is more accepted, but, you know, the trans widows are not accepted, that they are the horrible ones. And a lot of the lines you were saying were exactly the lines that were said to my mother back in the late 60s and early 70s about, oh, you need to just let him calm down, you know, as he's beating her up. You need to just, you know, stand by. There was the biblical line about, you know, Jesus said that you should forgive 7 times 70 times. You should forgive somebody. And my mom's response to that was, so I'm supposed to keep track of how many times he hits me, and when he get to 490, I can quit. But the point is that it was the same lines, but at a different, it's, do you see what I'm trying to get at? That it's the same attitudes. It's just at a different stage now. Does that make any sense?
It absolutely does. And it's true, because even in the case, what happened to your mother is the experience that I'm most familiar with, even when it happened to me. So I got divorced, I think, in 2012, 13-ish. I am not sure. I'm glad I'm not sure. But when it happened, I had some of my family members tell me that, you know, I have this tendency to be open and bold, as they'd like to call it. And they accused me for having caused the drift between me and my ex-husband, and that somehow I might have been responsible that he decided to end this marriage, as opposed to, are you okay? Did he hurt you? That never came out of anybody's mouth. And this was like a decade ago. So I completely empathize with what your mother went through. And some of the questions that these family members had asked me was just plain, I was so bewildered, because I thought that time and age when it happened to me, I was thinking, you were abused by your husband. You wish somebody would let you divorce that man so you could have a better life. How could you say that I should just put up with it because, you know, he's a quote unquote nice guy, or that I might have caused it because I just have like this mouth on me that would, you know, cause any man to leave me, and, you know, so on and so forth. So the pattern has been the same. Misogyny has been the same. It's just same shit, different era, as they call it. Right now, it's just the same exact model, the same exact template, but the cause for divorce is the fact that the man is trans-identifying and the woman is the bigot. And how your own mother got expelled from the church for daring to say no to an abusive man, similarly, these trans widows are kicked out of their friend circles, family circles, if they're of faith, from probably their faith circles as well, because, you know, nobody wants to really touch it because it's just a weird topic. You don't know what to say. You don't know how to comfort someone if you want to at all. Or it's so easy to admonish someone about this because the world kind of fuels, sort of gives you power for being horrible to women like that, of being horrible to people like us for standing against this. You know, it just gives them so much power to say, how horrible of you. How dare you leave him? He was just in this journey. How could you just abandon him like this? So it makes perfect sense for even an ordinary person to not think about it, because it's so validating to accuse women of the misgivings, because it's like saying, how dare you didn't stay long enough to be beaten to death, is what they're trying to say to me, if you really ask me.
How dare a woman have a boundary?
Indeed.
I mean, that's really the central. And sorry if we're getting too far away from your film. We'll go back to your film in a second. But, you know, how it seems to me that the central notion of patriarchy is that women are not allowed to have boundaries and women are not allowed to say no to men. It seems to me that the central impulse of patriarchy is that men can do whatever they want to women,
including becoming women themselves and calling themselves to be the better women than the rest of us. Yes, you're right. Patriarchy gives men the power to be a better woman than a woman itself. They are trying to emulate us. They are trying to be us. They're trying to wear us.
And sorry, I want to go one more direction before we go back to the film, which is, I love the line by Andrea Dworkin about, and she says it better than this, but basically how conservative men or right-wing men think that women are private property and liberal men or left-wing men think that women are public property. And we see that in the various forms of sort of right-wing misogyny versus left-wing misogyny. And how can you be more public property than to be what anybody declares you, anybody who can be one who declares they are one, as well as their support for pornography, prostitution, women are just public property to be passed around.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you'd be shocked to hear that the story is kind of similar in my country as well, even though the demarcation of right-wing and left-wing is not as clear as it is, in, say, in the U.S. or with the Labour and this thing in the U.K. But the approach or the mindset about what a woman is pretty much in these two camps, you know. One believes that a woman is free to do anything she wants. That includes completely being an object, be pro, quote unquote, sex work, pro porn, pro everything. And there is this other camp that knows exactly what a woman is, and they want them to stay in the kitchen and probably in the Flintstone era, and just stay there and not move an inch from there. So it's like I don't want to say rock in a hard place, because that almost seems nice at this stage, but I suppose it's a cruel and a crueler place for women to exist in this world right now. On the one side, you want the liberal community just pushing them to, against their will, be subjected to hypersexuality and misogyny of that sense. And then there is the right wing that is pushing them decades back, asking them to go back to the kitchen and open a pickle jar or make a sandwich or, you know, things like that. So on the one hand, you have women coming out and achieving many things. But if you really think about it, I just constantly I marvel at the thought of how well, how much more women can do if patriarchy was even a percentage less impactful as it is right now. Just one percentage, if you turn it down one notch, I just wonder how much more women can achieve, how much more self-confidence young girls can have. I just marvel at this thought.
Thank you for that. Let's go back to the film. And you said where you got the idea. And can you talk about what your first steps in making it were? Like, how did you find the women? How have you, presumably with essentially no budget, how have you been able to interview women from 40 countries? And then talk a little bit after that, talk a little bit about the form you see the final film taking. Is it going to be like, what is going to be the, is it going to be talking heads, or is it going to also have anything else? What else is the film going? Nothing wrong with a film that has a lot of talking heads, but what is the film going to be? So those are two questions.
Sure. Well, I did have my hesitations and I did wonder if enough women would trust me, a complete stranger, with their stories, because these are stories I will hesitate to even tell a therapist, right? Because the women basically cut a piece of their heart and gave it to me, you know, in the sense of sharing their stories of such horrific nature and trusting me, a complete stranger, with that. So the women who've spoken with me for this film are my absolute heroes. They are the film. You know, I'm making this for them. And with every passing day, I keep getting this nervousness and anxiety that I need to do a good job with this, because I need to do right by them for allowing themselves to be so open and honest. And just, I mean, I get teary-eyed when I just speak about it, but it's true. Without the women coming forward and trusting me with this, there is no film. So having said that, I did have hesitations in the beginning, but a lot of women managed to come forward and speak with me. Many were happy to go public. I interviewed close to 40 women, I think 40, 41 or something women, and 18 stories are going to be featured in the film. 10 are public about their experiences, which is to say that they're happy to show their face and share their story as themselves. And 8 of them are the women who are sharing their story with their own voice. Only the visuals would be animated, because they still aren't ready to be public with their experience because of many reasons. And it's perfectly okay. I mean, the fact that they were willing to talk to me anonymously and put their story outside in itself was such a remarkable thing, if you ask me. So I had no qualms about, you know, I wasn't the one to say, oh, well, you know, don't you think it would be nice if we go public, etc. It's not my place at all. But I truly value the women who are anonymous and are still, despite their fears, have come forward and participated in the film. So you have 8 anonymous stories and 10 public stories. Apart from that, there are interviews of subject matters of different kinds, including media, law, academia, and just feminist activism and things like that. How all of these things sort of come together. I would juxtapose the women's stories alongside say some historical reference of how it all began. And when a woman talks about issues with custody and the legalities, how it is misogynistic in nature, I'd probably juxtapose that with having somebody who's experienced in this department to confirm what she's saying, that this is the law and this is how women are treated, etc. So it's going to be talking heads, yes, but it's going to take you through a journey of how it all began to how it is right now, and the kind of laws that have changed over the years, and the influence of pornography and feminist advocacy alongside this to end transgenderism, etc. So it's going to be like a bag of multiple things, which I hope I can fit in somehow within this one film, you know, one feature length documentary, because as you can imagine, it's a long history we're talking about and a feminist struggle that, I don't know, predates my birth. But this is how I hope the film would look like. Some animated characters and some public characters, yes.
I have a more serious question in a moment, but I guess this is serious too, but this is more technical. How are you going to get the animation done? Do you do animation, or you got friends who have already signed on to do the animation, or how is that going to work?
So I have 4 women in India who are working with me on this project, who have each taken up a character and are creating them from scratch. We're giving them, none of my crew members have access to how these anonymous women look like. They can only hear them. Only I have spoken with the women directly. So I take their anonymity rather seriously. I have the women sign a non-disclosure agreement and things like that before signing them up, to even have them listen to their voice. That's how particular I am that their anonymity is maintained to the very end. So I have 4 animators here in India, and I have just recently signed up an animator from Pakistan who I've successfully piqued during the conversation, and she's happy to come on board for that. So there are women who are very good at their creative style, and because it takes time in the process, while I'm waiting, I'm also dabbling with animation myself, and I'm creating a lot of clips because there is just so much work to do. So I'm, like, I've taught myself to edit, like I've taught myself to direct and screenwrite, etc. I'm now teaching myself to animate as well a little bit, not as wonderfully as the animators themselves, but I'm trying to create these little clips that go as a complimentary things when women are speaking, etc. So anyway, there are women and there are some men in the film crew, not necessarily as animators, but, you know, other departments, etc. So it's a largely female-led crew. And when the film is made and when people come together to support it, they're supporting not just me, but the entire all-female crew, etc. So 4 animators from India, 1 animator from Pakistan so far, and I'm not even nearly on the verge of finishing the film. There's still a long way to go.
So now I want to go back to the other point, which was 8 out of the 18 women wanted to be anonymous. And I just want to highlight again the thing about Jermaine Greer, that men have no, women and men have no idea how much men hate them, in that I have been interviewed for, oh gosh, probably 500 films, 300 films, you know, a lot of times for, you know, short videos, long, you know, the point is I've been interviewed a lot. And I have written and been interviewed about some extremely controversial things. And never once did it occur to me that I might have to be anonymous in the film. And yet more than 45% of these women felt it necessary to be anonymous. And that goes along with, there was just an article came out today about the violence against women who speak out in favor of women's spaces. And it is absolutely standard. It's absolute common knowledge among anybody who dares to speak out on this at all, that you are at the very least putting your career at risk and quite possibly putting your life at risk. And you, we didn't talk about it this time, but when I interviewed you before, one of the times you mentioned that in your bio was that, hold on, let me find it. I want to get the exact words. At one point you were, her last film, but what was she wearing? Gave her the title of canceled feminist. That was a couple films ago or a couple interviews ago. And the point is, well, I'm just going to stop and you take this for now. I think it's striking that almost 50% of the women found it necessary to be anonymous. That's extraordinary to me. And I just want to highlight again, that wouldn't happen to most men unless they're in the witness protection program.
You're absolutely right. And it's true for me as well. And the longer I put myself out about this, the harsher my criticisms and trolling and vitriol online gets. So it's true that when women speak out against gender identity ideology, the shit that comes her way is far exceeding, I mean, exponentially more than when a man speaks out against it. In fact, sometimes men walk away with more glory, perhaps. Sometimes they get more accolades. Sometimes they get more opportunities for having been so brave in talking against this ideology, like only a man could. While women here are, you know, been screaming from the top of our voices for years now, and we get absolutely not a single cookie for it. Similarly, the women in our film have also felt that way because they could speak, you know, publicly, but I can't afford to have my film put their life in danger in any shape or form, because more than anyone else, I know what it costs to be public. So I was very, very almost protective of these women, even though they are older than me, or it doesn't even matter. I feel so protective of them that if there was going to be any form of danger, I would advise them to, you know, speak, think very hard before going public about this. It was only those 10 women who were absolutely sure that they do want this, and interviews elsewhere online are already available, so it's not new information. So these women were happy to be public because the danger period, they've crossed that. But there are these women, almost 50%, like you say, haven't crossed that danger line, but they still want to talk about it. And that's just so amazing and telling about how much women want to come away from it. You know, I would like to think of it as tomorrow, say it 5 years from now, somebody were to make a film on this topic again, there would probably be more women who are public about it and even more women who are anonymous about it, but they're on this path where eventually they'll come out public against this ideology. You know, that's how I'd like to see it. So when women choose to be anonymous, I think it's only right to be respectful of it, because other women know the danger associated with being public about it, because other women have had shit coming their way, you know, in words I can't describe. So while it would have been great that everybody in the film was public about it, you know, looking directly into the camera and saying, I say no to this bullshit, I think that time is coming. It will come. But for now, we have a mixture of women who are speaking publicly and women who are in no less effective or anything like that while being anonymous, but are still willing to come forth and log their experience. And I think that's just phenomenal.
So I want to be clear that I wasn't criticizing the women who were anonymous. I was pointing out that shows the level of fear that this movement engenders.
You're right, and I agree with you. I wasn't thinking that you were implying that at all, but you know more than anyone else the importance of being anonymous, especially women, because we know what the trans rights activists are capable of. We've seen cases where women are being doxxed, women are being chased after, women are being attacked. We've seen everything in this day and age. So we empathize with women who choose to be anonymous, and you don't have to. Derek, I'm perfectly clear. What do you think? Yeah.
So your line about how you hope that in 5 years a documentary would more women would be would feel comfortable not being anonymous reminds me of the line by the suffragist Millicent Fawcett, who said, courage calls to courage everywhere and its voice cannot be denied.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And these women, when by the time they finish having this conversation with me, you know, they are so energized by just recording their story in some sense that they are so tempted to go public with it, you know. But we will have to exercise due diligence, because it might just be really amazing in that moment to just go public, but the women have to worry about their children. The children are probably going to some schools and other children might bully them. They did not sign up for this. I mean, it's unfortunate that it happened to the children, but they didn't sign up to being bullied at school or, you know, being treated as an outcast, etc. So the women have to take into consideration things, not just about her, but about so many different things. So courage calls to courage, yes, 100%, but I hope even anonymous courage calls to more courage everywhere, is what I want to say.
Well, I think also it really helps to make a public forum where people can even anonymously acknowledge their experience. And I remember when I first read Judith Herman's wonderful book, Trauma and Recovery, about just how extraordinary it was to read a book that discussed PTSD even. And it's the same here, that I've seen your other work, and I know that this film will also, by giving voice to these, will encourage other women to be able to speak their experiences too.
Indeed. And I'm with you about Judith Herman's book. That book opened my eyes. When I read it, my recovery felt like it was going at a much better pace as I was consuming her words and how she broke down trauma, how she broke down recovery, etc. So it was very, very helpful for me. And I could see the same thing in the voices of these women as well, public and anonymous, it doesn't matter. They are angry, Derek. They are angry. What is it about this world that you're not even curious to know what the wives think? Like, how can it be that we live in a world where you just one day decide, that's it. This is the community that we want to champion. Anybody else, we don't care. It hasn't been this blatant in the past, you know. There have been debates about people of faith and atheists, and they've had congregations, meetings where both of them have sort of spoken on the same stage, shared, you know, handshakes and things like that. But while religion, challenging religion, it was so difficult at that time. This seems like a neo-religion, which shan't be challenged whatsoever. And anyone who does not approve of it or affirm it would have to be instantly banished into the hell gates or something like that. That's how these women are being treated. And that's why these women are angry. Aren't you even curious to know that there are women who resist it? That was the motivation for me to pick up this film because, well, I'm curious. Of course I'm curious. I'm more than curious. In fact, I want to scream about this. And when these women talk about this, they are on the path of recovery. And I hope listening to the voices of these women, other women who are still stuck in this, can look at themselves, imagine themselves on the path of recovery too. Because after all, these resources are there to help women, you know, have access to a phenomenon that makes them feel less alone, right? That's why we're doing all this. That's why we write books. That's why we make films. That's why we have podcasts, so that we feel some sort of a togetherness in this absolute calamity that is this world. And I hope, you know, like you say, the film that puts these voices together could serve as a form of recovery for the women in the film as well as the women who are listening to the film.
So I think you've been pretty clear. We only have a couple minutes left, and you've been pretty clear about what you want from the film itself and what you would hope that listeners, the watchers of the film would take away. But you said, you said in your bio at the beginning that you're seeking funds to complete this. So can you talk about two things? One is, what percentage are you done with the film, do you think? And I mean, are you quarter of the way, halfway, three quarters? And if somebody does want to support the film, we'll also find out more about the film. Is there a place? So three questions. One, what percentage are you done? Two, how can people find out more about your work in general? And three, how can people support the film?
Sure. So it's hard to describe it with a percentage, but I will say that apart from having these voices in the film, this is like, say, if it's a 2-hour film, the women, each of them have spoken to me for about hour and a half to 2 hours. So it's not all going to be in the film. That's not possible. So what I'm trying to do is, apart from the film, which is going to be like a journey of all of these things, a little bit of history, influence of pornography, feminist advocacy, etc., etc., I'm also thinking of releasing individual stories on YouTube as a way of keeping the conversation going and to benefit somebody, say a woman who is having something very, very similar going on with her, but she could only hear about 2 minutes of that story in the main film. She can benefit from listening to her complete story later on, which is also going to be on YouTube. So the individual stories are all done. And now the main film's edit is going on. And the main film's edit is heavily dependent on the animation because 8 characters are being built from scratch. So we have 18 short videos ready to go on YouTube with just their voices, but we are now creating these animations for the 8 characters so that, you know, it looks as if I don't want to have like a silhouette image or something like that. You know, it's just really sad. I want these women to be in a very well lit room, looking confident and courageous and, you know, formidable when they are speaking about their story. I don't want them to be hidden away in a silhouette or something like that. So I'm creating these characters, giving them that face or whatever. So all of those things are expensive. Animation is expensive. So the percentage of the film would be, let's say, I hope to release the film end of this year. That's my hope. So the sooner the funds come, the easier it would be to animate, pay the women and have the footage ready, and the sooner it can get released. So that's where we are. To know more about my work and my films company is called Lime Soda Films, and limesodafilms.com has every bit of information that anyone needs if they want to find out more about my work. And Vaishnavi Sundar Turf would fetch all sorts of results on Google, so I'm very easy to find online.
Can you spell your name, please, for people not from India?
Sure. Vaishnavi, Vaishnavi Sundar, Sundar. It's, you just type a vague name and it usually shows up. I've noticed people who can't really pronounce my name just type out vague understanding of what my name would spell, would they think spells like. So they just type that out and they somehow arrive where they want to. They eventually find me, is what I'm trying to say. So, and the final question is, how can people help in finishing this project? Is I'm seeking donations to complete this project. As we've discussed, I've been cancelled and I have had all sorts of commission jobs, writing gigs that I used to have before, and that's how I used to make a living while also doing full-time advocacy, is by writing for feminist magazines and about films, about criticisms and things like that. But now all of that is gone. I don't have those opportunities in India anymore. I don't have a source of income in India anymore. So whatever I do, I kind of do it out of the savings that I've had while I used to work in corporate organizations back in the day, but that's just soon depleting. And like Dysphoric, I want to make this film available for everybody to watch. But as you know, films are expensive to make. So I urge all the listeners, it doesn't matter if you want to spare $1, $2, $100, $1,000, it doesn't matter. Any little or anything at all is good enough. If you you know, think that you want to support this project, you can send them my way. LimesodaFilms.com has all the information. And you can find me on social media. You can write to me. You can reach out to me however you please if you wish to support this. And I can help you with you know, ways in which we can do that together. So I sincerely hope that the listeners would chip in whatever little they can. And if they can't, that then they would have some of their friends listen to this podcast and have them probably donate. What I want to say is no amount is big or small. And it would be amazing if we can finish this film together.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world. And thank you for making this film. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Vaishnavi Sundar. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.